Hello. You are welcome to Tales from the Heart, a weekly storytelling podcast where we thrill and entertain you with fictional paranormal African stories. This is our pilot episode, and I am your storyteller, The Grizzly. On today's episode, we have four short stories to share with you, and you must like them. Feel free to share with everybody, especially on social media. You can send us an email, talesfromtheheart@gmail.com. Check the description for links to our social media handles, and do well to follow us for updates, and don't forget to click on the follow button and leave us a comment. Enjoy our first stories. Have you ever wondered where your family blessings come from? Let me introduce to you the family of six in our first short story of this episode. The story is titled, The Family Wealth. 2 weeks before my father died, he called us for a meeting. All six of us, excluding our mother. He told us his time was near and would love to pass on something to all of us.
Since you were kids, have you wanted for anything?
He asked us. No, sir, we chorused.
Good. But do you know why?
Confused, I turned to my siblings and matched their bewildered shrugs. Papa said nothing for a while. He stabbed the floor tile twice with his staff before looking up.
I asked a question.
No idea, sir. I answered on behalf of my siblings. He placed the staff across his laps and sank back into his favorite cushion. The silence was deafening as we waited for him to tell us the reason for his summon. Papa, who rarely commented on the family WhatsApp group, had dropped, "My time is near, and I need you all at the Otobi Estate on the 12th of August, 1 p.m. I have an important thing I need to share with you all. No excuses." Of course, the mention of death was enough to drag us down to Otobi Estate. He had given us a week's notice to plan and come down from our different locations. We grew up knowing Papa as a hard and detached father. Yes, he provided for us, sent us to the best schools, and provided capital for four of us who were entrepreneurs. He was disappointed with Afam, who chose to become a pastor. Nevertheless, he was the biggest donor to his ministry. As for Obodozie, Papa helped him secure a juicy job with an LNG company. Papa was pragmatic, never dramatic. So it was with fear and worry that we all landed in Otobi Estate. He wasn't ill. At least, that's what Mama said. He was 87, but was strong for his age. He lived a life of moderation. That he had money never meant that he indulged in frivolities. He took care of himself, played tennis every weekend for over 50 years, and drank more water than alcohol. He kept a full bar, but it was for visitors, worthy visitors, who were hosted in his own private parlor. The rest were entertained in the general parlor with juice and roasted goat meat. As he sank and adjusted himself on his cushion, I watched him closely. He looked tired, and I have never seen him tired. His eyes dropped by the sides and his lips were curved down in a tired line. I watched him close his eyes as he patted the staff on his lap. I glanced at my siblings and noted their respectful postures. one we learned to adopt in his presence. I cleared my throat to speak, and it immediately hit me that the throat clearing sounded just like Papa's. I stifled a chuckle and put on my CEO face.
Papa, do you need water? I should be asking you that question,
he retorted with his eyes still closed.
Your throat sounds like it needs to be cooled down.
Obudozie began to laugh like a hyena. It was exceptionally funny to him, but not to me. Reason? Papa only cracked a joke when he was very nervous, and he was not always nervous.
So none of you have ever wondered the reason behind your success?
Alarm bells went off in my head. A quick glance around the room showed that I wasn't alone. Jaws dropped, faces lined with worry, butts adjusted on chairs, legs shuffling on the tiled floor. Truth be told, especially in my teens, I had hardly wondered if Dad belonged to any secret cult. But that thought was killed each time I recalled our family history. We, the Otobis, have always been wealthy and successful. Anything we touched became gold. Our great-grandfather had been a slave merchant and was the most successful in our village. Our great-grandfather and grandfather made a killing in the oil palm business too. Our father made his own killing in the petroleum sector. We were upcoming with our own killings in our own enterprises too. We had money. We have never not had money.
Every April in this family, we have a feast. Have you never wondered why?
Papa asked. Obudozie chuckled and said, I thought it was because we were exceptionally happy for the death and resurrection of Jesus. Papa had sniggered and called him a fool. We all chuckled at that because we agreed with him. Obudozie was a clown, a foolish clown. Papa had let out a heavy sigh and stroked his staff as if to comfort himself.
What we always celebrate in this home every April is called Ibuaku, Gathering of Wealth. It's a celebration that our ancestors began after they had a pact with the gods. In exchange for wealth and success every season, the gods demanded worship and sacrifice, he said.
It was at that point I realized how much I wanted to remain in ignorance. I didn't want to know more, and I'm sure my siblings shared my sentiment. So I wasn't surprised when Afam spoke up.
Do you mean to tell us we have been practicing idolatry in this family? Is that what you're saying?
Papa squinted his eyes as if to see Afam clearly.
Churchman. Englishman, yes, if that's what you call tradition. Yes, idolatry has been funding your church. Idolatry bought you that private jet.
Papa sneered.
So what are you going to do about it?
When he got no response from Afam, he continued.
Look, I know you don't mind eating and drinking that comes with Ibuaku. You are all squeamish because I mentioned sacrifice. Your father is no murderer. Neither was his father. Human sacrifice in this family stopped a long time ago with your great-grandfather.
He shook his head and slowly scratched his jaw.
Every April, the head of the family has to renew our covenant with the gods. The Itego needs to be rejuvenated with blood. seen our skeptic looks, he added, blood of a pregnant female cow. That's all. One could hear the sigh of relief from each of us. I tried not to believe what Papa said. Ikwaku, itego. But I've seen enough in the world to know that good and evil spirits coexist with us. I desperately wanted to know what kind we were dealing with. A god that gave us security in exchange for the blood of a cow? Where did that fall? Good? Bad? Papa, I'm afraid I cannot be part of this. I believe in hard work, and I believe it is what kept the Utobis where they are. As a Christian and as a servant of the Lion of Judah, Papa busted out laughing. Afam looked like he ate lemons. Papa laughed so hard that I had to get water for this spasmy cough that accompanied the laughter. Afam, he said when he caught his breath. Sit down. Sit this one out. Dozier here is the head after I am gone. He pointed at me. I only called all of you here so that you are aware of the reason for our tradition. I don't want you carrying your righteousness on your heads to fight him. He turned to my sisters. Ihuoma, Ihunaya, you are also covered up by Ikwaku. Any child with Utuobi blood is covered by Itego. He lifted his staff and pointed it at Ihuoma. Your husband has been a benefactor of Ikwaku. Do you remember how he was when he came to ask for your hand in marriage? Ihuoma's lips thinned, but Papa took no notice of her irritation. Did I give him 1 naira? But look at him now. He turned to me. Dozi, as my first son, this mantle of chief priests falls on you. You are the mediator with our gods now. You are responsible for the welfare and happiness of this Utuobi dynasty. Anything you choose to do with the mantle handed to you is your business. I have enjoyed my time here on Earth, and I want you to do the same for not just you, but your children and those that will follow. Dynasties build a nation, and Utuobi won't be caught short. We work hard, yes. Others outside these walls do too. The grace the church preaches is also existent here, but in the form of gods first given to us. They do us no harm, and we do them no harm. All they ask is that we finish what we started. I deliberately left out Christian talk because it colors our prism sometimes. I can't force you to take this. It has to be your own choice because the gods can smell an unwilling spirit. They do not like it. You can play lukewarm in Christianity, but not with these ones. He glanced around the room. Keep this tradition alive. It doesn't demand much. In the 38 years of my life, we have never had a long talk with our father. The urgency with which he spoke told me that he believed what he was saying. I wasn't scared, but I wasn't eager to take up the mantle too. So I asked one question that had been plaguing me since this revelation. Papa, I began, what happens if I don't take this up? If no one continues the whole worship and sacrifice thing,
From the corner of my eye, I saw my siblings sit up straight. Apparently, they cared to know if poverty was a one less cow blood away from them. Papa had stared at me for a while, sat up straight, and adjusted himself. When he had gotten comfortable, he tapped his staff on the tile and stared at his shoe. Then he looked up and said to none of us in particular, "No one knows exactly what the terms were. Poverty, death, infertility. No one knows. All we know is we are high above everyone else in this region, and we want to keep it that way. We don't even want to test that water, because if the covenant truly holds, then the disaster that would follow will be greater than what will never happen if the covenant doesn't exist." After we had buried Papa, as we walked down to his library in silence, Afam quietly asked, "Will you do it?" I was silent for some seconds before I answered, "I don't know." I saw them look at each other, and I saw something on their face. Fear. Our second story is about a desperate soul and its hosts. It is titled, "The Road That Leads Home." The queue on this side is always long, but moves quickly because everyone gets attended to fast. In this side, there is no need for long talk, pleasantries, and the likes that take up the time of humans. In this place, things move fast, for everyone here had once lived as humans, but now they exist as souls. Souls waiting for their cycle to complete before they can inhabit a human body and live again as human. However, the gatekeepers, wise and all-seeing beings, are the ones who are in charge of the portal connecting souls and human bodies. Their job is to ensure that the souls who seek to cross over completed their cycle and are ready to experience life as a human better than they had in their previous life. Many have their reasons for seeking a chance. Some are good, some aren't. On that queue was a soul who desperately wants to have another chance. Its reason isn't a good one, but it had completed its cycle and was qualified to experience life again. When it got to its turn, the gatekeeper took a long, hard look at it. "This is your first," she said. It wasn't a question, it was a statement. But the desperate soul responded nevertheless. "Yes, it is. May I see into you?" she requested. Grudgingly, the desperate soul opened up itself and showed the gatekeeper all its past lives and experience as a human. Suddenly, the gatekeeper drew back in horror. She had not expected the intensity of what she'd been shown. In a soft tone, she said to the desperate soul, "You have 8 chances, so you have to be careful in choosing your pathway. A lost chance is a lost chance forever. No do-over." When the desperate soul said nothing, she pointed at a cluster of souls to her left and continued, "Join them. From there you get to see many pathways, some familiar, some not so familiar. Now you get to choose your destiny, so make it count." As the desperate soul turned to leave, she reached out a hand and held it gently. "Do you still have anger in you?" she asked softly. The desperate soul said nothing in response, but shook off the gatekeeper's hand. The gatekeeper knew she was overdoing her job, and the soul knew it too. But she was worried for the host.
the new body that the desperate soul would inhabit. What she had seen in the soul was not reassuring. Souls like desperate souls made terrible humans, and when they died, they become restless souls taunting the living. They cause trouble in the realm of souls and the living. So she sighed in resignation and said to desperate soul, "That comes to every human, although with different faces. Yours was a brutal face, but I see no need to hold on to a past life when you have another chance to live a good one. Please be kind to your new host."
Then she let the soul go and watched it as it joined other souls at the portal. At the portal, souls had to select their pathways. Pathways were images of women who were open to conceiving a child and were in the state of it at the time. Desperate soul honed in on a middle-aged woman who was in bed with her husband as they celebrated the 30th wedding anniversary. She was ripe, and desperate soul latched onto her ovaries with glee. It was time to come back and wreak havoc as a human. The host he latched onto was named Mrs. Assumpta Adjoniki. She was 51 years old and hadn't experienced menopause yet. She thought she had because of a sparse menstrual cycle and hot flashes, so she hadn't taken precautions against getting pregnant. A few weeks later, Assumpta knew she was pregnant. She had been through pregnancy 5 times, so she knew the second her body changed. She was happy and scared. All her kids had left home for jobs and university, so the thought of a child, comfort child, was welcoming to her. Unfortunately, her husband didn't share this sentiment with her and requested she terminate the pregnancy. After much begging and crying, her husband refused to back down, so Assumpta had to book a termination surgery at the hospital. When she got to the hospital, she picked the phone and dialed Mike, her husband, again. She wanted to plead with him one last time. She picked a call and she spoke hurriedly.
"Mike, I don't want to do this. I understand that age isn't on our side. What is so bad about having another child in our 50s?
she asked tearfully. Mike's breath on the phone came in quick succession. Assumpta knew he was frustrated, but was trying to rein it in.
"Assumpta, our last child is 18 years old. Do you think I have time for diapers and school run now? Also, how sure are we that you will survive childbirth at your age? Remember how John's birth went? I almost lost you," he said.
"Honey, please," she pleaded. "I am strong enough for this. I am mentally prepared for this. You will love him or her like..."
"I have no doubt that I will, but I don't want this. Get it over with. Next week, I will go get snipped so this mistake doesn't happen again, please."
The call ended. He had cut it. Just then, the doctor came into the room and Assumpta quickly wiped off her tears. She was elderly and had a kind face.
"Good afternoon, Mrs. Adjoniki."
He smiled at her, so she forced a smile back in return. Suddenly, all business. He flipped through the file in his hands.
"The test says you are 18 weeks gone. Well, this is a D&E case, considering how advanced you are. I mean the pregnancy. I know you are worried, but be rest assured it's a touch and go. You are in safe..."
The phone beeped. A startled Assumpta glanced at the phone and picked it up. Realizing the doctor was silent, she offered an apology.
"Sorry, it's a text from my husband."
The doctor nodded and said, "Carry on. I will meet you in the theater in 5, okay?"
"Okay," Assumpta replied. She watched him exit the door and quickly clicked on the text message from her husband.
Her heart raced as she hoped it would be a text saying he'd changed his mind about aborting the baby. Honey, when you are done, give me a call so I can come take you home. I don't want you driving after the procedure. Junior will come pick up your car from the hospital later. I love you. Her heart sunk. A nurse walked in and signaled Azumta to follow her. Finally, Azumta was prepped for the termination surgery. Meanwhile, inside her, Desperate Soul gained consciousness. It sensed that something was wrong. Its chosen host was doing something to her body, to his new vessel. Something was pushing and poking, so Desperate Soul decided to take a look. Wait. It wasn't yet time to be born. It wasn't yet 9 months, so why are they pulling out his vessel, the fetus? Desperate Soul panicked as it watched its frail vessel being pulled out. Did it miss out something about its host when choosing this pathway? It had chosen Azumta in a hurry because it couldn't wait any longer. So why was its host doing this to herself? Desperate Soul wondered wildly. Just when it was starting to merge its soul spirits into the flesh inside her, why was she denying it a chance at life? Its first chance at reincarnation was going to be a failure. It was down to 7. This made Desperate Soul angry and mad. So it tried to search forward as the doctor pulled out the fetus into the light, and immediately Desperate Soul felt itself being zapped back into a void. It was going back to square one. In anger, it struck and lashed out at its host Azumta before the gatekeepers pulled it back in completely to their realm. Meanwhile, in the hospital, the nurse screamed in panic as Azumta bled and went into shock. Doctor, look! Something is wrong. She's hemorrhaging. As the doctor and his nurse tried to save Azumta's life, her soul seeped out of her. The soul that was Azumta took one last sad look at the big clump of blood splattered in the tray, which was on the table, before answering the call of her ancestors. It is time to begin her own cycle. In our next story, be sure to know that you cannot fight destiny. It is titled Destiny's Destination. She knew this day would come. After all, it was her destiny, so she never prepared for it. But the moment it came, she ran. She ran and prayed to the gods to guide her. So they listened and guided her little feet. For 7 moons, she had been fed well, pampered and oiled. From birth, she had been marked as the Ihil. The moment she came out of her mother's womb first, while holding her dead brother's ankle, she had been marked for death by all. She was a curse for being a girl, and for coming out first. Her stubbornness killed her brother, for which man wants to be behind a woman? Which man? She knew when it was time because the whisper ceased and everyone averted their gaze whenever she was around. That night, when she heard the drums beat rhythmically, her heart skipped. Not wanting to believe it was her time, she ran outside her hut and met the dark night. Everyone had put out their light. Mavanyi, it's time. Her father's voice in that darkness jolted her, so she ran. As she ran, she heard the tempo of the drum change. She knew it would bring everyone out to chase her. Men, women, children. Her playmates would come for her because her death meant cleansing and fertility for all. She ran and let the gods lead her. They led her to the cave. Here, the gods would protect her. Here, her late mother and brother would watch over her, she strongly believed. So as she lay still, crying silently inside the cold cave, she didn't notice something cold slither close to her. Suddenly, she felt a weight on her and tried to get up, but the cold thing slyly slipped around her and held her tight. The more she struggled, the more it squeezed. She gagged and choked. She vomited as tears fell from her eyes. She thought of her dad, who never loved her like his other children. She thought of other kids who only played with her when no adult was around. Then she thought no more. Outside the cave, the chief priests, her father, and the villagers waited in silence as the cave shook. When it stopped, they knew Mavanyi had met her destiny. For in that cave lay a god awaiting its sacrifice, its meal. The gods indeed be praised. Sometimes, dreams are stranger than fiction. Our final story is titled The Lover's Web. Something was wrong. He knew it. Something was off. He could feel it. The air smelled different. No, it didn't smell. It hung. It hung there thick and heavy, like it didn't exactly exist. Why is it so dark? He wondered as he craned his neck to look at his girlfriend, whom he was so sure was lying beside him. Dark. Everywhere was dark. He tried to move his hand, but met a barrier. Panic set in. His mind quickly made a calculation. Heavy air or lack of it. Darkness and a barrier. He was locked in a box. At this realization, he muttered, "No, no, no," and clawed wood above him. He quickly noted that the box was narrow because he couldn't move his hands on his sides, but he noticed he could lift it to push the wooden box lid above him. "This isn't a standard casket," he thought as he resumed clawing and pushing the box lid. "I am not buried. There is no way I am buried alive," he muttered. Hot tears leaked from his eyes as he fought for air. Fearing suffocation, he began to frantically kick and punch the lid. He even began to scream in hopes that someone out there would hear him. He screamed and cried and asked God to help him, to forgive him, to give him a second chance. He cried and called out to his father. At this point, he wished the stories about guardian spirits were real. His late father ought to be his. That's the least he should do for his son, whom he left behind in the world at the age of 10. No, he didn't want to die like a fowl. He tried to remember his day. Where had he gone to? Was he kidnapped from his house? Could this be a prank? How did he fall into the hands of ritualists? It must be ritualists, he concluded. He started to scream anew when he imagined an old native doctor waiting to cut him up after he had suffocated. Then he heard it. A sound from somewhere up. He steeled and tried to listen carefully. Whatever it was, sounded low, but rhythmic. "If I can hear it, then I am not buried," he thought. To him, it also meant the possibility of being heard. The hope of survival gave him strength and he began to pound and punch the box lid. Something was wrong. No, not like something wasn't wrong before. Something was more wrong. Then it hit him. The sound above had a pattern. He stopped all movement and lifted his head to listen better. Lord, it was a chant. No, chant from a crowd. He was a sacrifice. He was surrounded. He heard it now. The drums, the hums, the rhythm of the voices. Suddenly, the box moved. No, more like it was pushed, and then he felt it descend as the voices chanted and hummed as if in a frenzy. This time around, he became hysterical as he screamed, punched, and kicked the lid. He could feel the bruises on his hands and bare feet. He knew he was bleeding, but he had no care. He only wanted to live, to be let out. A soft, familiar laughter rang out in the darkness, but he was too distraught to place it. For some weird reason, Uma Thurman came to his mind. The scene where she was buried alive in Kill Bill came unbidden to him. This made him cry more than anything because he wished he had the skills she possessed so as to be able to save himself. Alas, life couldn't imitate art in this situation. He felt the box in which he was in drop. He squeezed shut his eyes as he braced for its impact with the bottom of his grave. But it never came. It was then that it dawned on him that he was falling. Or rather, the box was falling and falling like it had been dropped in a black hole. Resigned to his imminent death, he muttered, "Lord, accept my soul." It was then that he remembered. He remembered his girlfriend's face hovering over his with a smile. Yes, she was the last person he had. The box he was in finally landed on solid ground. He opened his eyes and in confusion and saw his girlfriend's face looming above him. It took him some seconds before he realizes he was laying on the cold tiles and his elbow hurt. He was sure he had broken it when he fell off the couch he'd been sleeping on. He shook his head as if he was trying to shake off cobwebs. As his girlfriend tried to help him stand, he glanced at the TV and saw Kill Bill 2 showing on it. His girlfriend had been watching it. When he settled back on the couch, he asked her, "Did you watch any other movie before this one playing?" His girlfriend peered at his face as if to ascertain that he didn't get an internal injury in his head when he fell off the couch. "Yes, a Nigerian horror ritual movie. It's old though. Why do you ask?" she inquired. "Nothing. I think I have heard it in the background as I slept. Just wanted to be sure I didn't dream it," he responded with a shrug. "Okay, please don't scare me like that again. The way you fell from the couch was frightening. I thought you hit your head on the floor," she said in a concerned voice. He shrugged off her statement. There was no way he was going to let her know of his dream. As he lay back on the couch, his girlfriend took a peek at him and smiled to herself. Mission 1 had been accomplished. His soul was next. I hope you enjoyed our stories today. Click on the follow button for notifications of our subsequent episodes. You wouldn't want to miss them. The stories for this week's episodes were written by Adachukwu Omudue and narrated by yours sincerely, The Grizzly. You can follow me on Twitter at CrunchGrizzly. That is K-R-U-N-C-H-G-R-I-Z-Z-L-Y. Sound was produced and mixed by Blue Magic OD of Magic City. Also, check him out on Twitter at BlueMagic_ODII. Tales from the Heart is a production of Creator Library and Publisher, a digital library and publishing platform that provides equitable access to research and knowledge resources. Check it out at www.thecreatorlibrary.com. You can check the description for all of those details. Thank you for listening. I will be with you next week.